You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
Everybody's afraid. They're all afraid of actually saying what it is that is going on in this world.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. Author Robert Greene rocketed to international prominence in 1998 with the publication of his first book, The 48 Laws of Power. The book took inspiration from writers like Machiavelli and Sun Tzu and distilled their ideas into principles to follow to get what you wanted and crush those who tried to stop you. Among the book's legions of fans were many prominent rappers. Jay-Z, Kanye West, and others shouted Greene out in interviews and songs. Another admirer was 50 Cent, who liked Greene so much that he sought him out to co-write a book, The 50th Law. Greene's latest book, Mastery, just out in paperback, is about how to discover and gain mastery over your life's work. I talked to Robert in the backyard of his beautiful home in Los Angeles. It's not that far from LAX, so you may hear the occasional airplane flying overhead. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL61. From there, you'll get audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Robert Greene. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm here with author Robert Greene. Thanks for having us in your lovely Los Angeles home.
Oh, you like it?
Yeah, very much.
Thank you.
It's famous, right? I got a big write-up in the Times a while back.
I don't know why, because it's not like a palatial house. People expect, you know, some kind of modern, exciting, sexy house. It's just an old Spanish bungalow. But, you know, it's got its charm.
You were saying in the article that you envisioned it as like the kind of, you know, house that someone who, you know, lived in Hollywood but wasn't a big star might have.
Yeah, and a lot of times, like, we love watching old Hollywood movies, like noir films or stuff, and you see a lot of locations in Los Angeles, like Double Indemnity. I don't know if you know that movie. And it's all near here. It's all in this area. And it's just a typical house in that period. So I also imagine maybe some kind of noir-like adventure took place here. It has a very famous, the only thing I could say is it has a very famous fireplace. Fireplaces by this artist in the 20s named Batchelder, and it is really actually quite weird if you look at it. So that's the only kind of claim to fame the house has.
Okay. Yeah. And your latest book just out in paperback is Mastery, which we were talking about before, and you know, I'd like a great deal. So congratulations on it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And the inspiration for that came, sort of the initial spark of inspiration for it came from someone our audience probably knows pretty well, right? Your former co-writer, 50 Cent.
Yeah, I mean, it was building in my head a little bit beforehand because my books sort of deal with these power figures. And I do this sort of intense research where I almost live with the people that I'm researching. And I've gotten really in-depth in Napoleon from my war book to the point where I, you know, he was like a friend of mine almost. And I had this feeling that there was something about him where he had this feel for warfare. And so the next book was with 50, and I was thinking a lot about Napoleon, and I even called 50 the Napoleon Bonaparte of hip-hop, because he is such a strategist, you know? So we sort of discussed it, and I was discussing in context of of his feel for music and the idea of going through an apprenticeship. I remember, you know, it was really striking because you think of a hip-hop artist, you don't really think of the words discipline so much necessarily. And so I was, even particularly in relation to 50, so it was really surprising to hear about his apprenticeship with Jam Master Jay and his whole time with Columbia Records and how he saw it as like his university education and all that. So it was really weird to like have him be kind of the incubation for this next book. But I like the fact that it was so weird that you wouldn't think about him in that context. And also from Pieces to Weight, which I don't know, people know what he discusses that book. I thought it was a really good book.
Yeah.
There was a lot in there about sort of the same themes in, that I ended up using in Mastery.
Rap Jeez.
Right. Like he, you talked about a time with Jam Master Jay. That was where he learned to write songs. He could always rap, but it, you know, putting it in a package people would like.
Yeah.
That was where he sort of first figured it out.
Yeah.
Excellent. And the whole way
he met Jam Master Jay, it was all clever and Machiavellian, and you know the whole point of how, you know, you just can't let chance happen who your mentor will be. He made it happen, and he followed him. He almost stalked him, and how he went into the club and made it. You know, that was kind of exciting to me too.
Yeah, and mentorship is a big concept in your book, right?
Yes.
It's one of the key ideas for people who are trying to gain mastery in a field is to have a mentor, and you talk about finding a mentor, the relationship you should have with your mentor, you know, at the beginning and at the end. Who, when you were writing, learning to be a writer, who do you consider your mentors looking back?
I didn't really have a mentor. Like writers, sometimes you don't, because it's kind of a lonely profession where you're not really, you don't go to school for it or anything. I had an English teacher in high school, and I once turned in an essay for him. I was like 16 or so, and I thought it was great. I was so full of myself. And he said, this is terrible. He gave me like an F on it. And he said, you know, you're writing for yourself. You're not thinking about who you're writing for, your audience. And it was like one of those moments, you know, where a light bulb went on and I thought, wow, that's really, really interesting. And I never, ever since then have ever made that mistake again where I'm thinking about the sound of my own words and how impressed I am with that. So he was kind of a key figure. And then years later, when I did my 48 Laws of Power, Yost Elfer is the guy who produced my first three books. He's a mentor for the business side of publishing, which is really important. It's just as important as the creative side. You know, he showed me, you know, it's like a business like anything. It's not as awful as the music business. You know, there's not as many sharks, but it can be pretty bad, particularly now. So he gave me a great mentorship in how to handle that kind of world. So those would be maybe the two main figures. But then there are all the other writers that I've loved throughout my life who I would consider my mentors just spiritually because I love their style and I kind of absorbed it.
Nice. And so all the studying you did of mentor-mentee relationships over the years, in the process of writing the book or afterwards, have you become a mentor to anyone?
I get about three requests a day from people asking me.
Right. Do they actually ask you that? Can you mentor me overtly?
I can show you. Yeah, they come right out and say it. Will you be my mentor? I feel sad because if I had more time, maybe I would explore it. And who knows, maybe there is somebody out there who one of these people would have been absolutely perfect. But, you know, I don't have the time. And I have, prior, my researcher, Ryan Holiday, he's gone on to become even, you know, much more well-known than I am. He's going to, you know, he's, I don't know if you've heard of him. Ryan wrote his own book, what's it called? Trust Me, I'm Lying. And he's now writing his third book. But he was my apprentice for a while. And now I have a new one. So I basically take someone who I'm going to hopefully turn into a writer, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. And the format of the book is you go through kind of biographies of people you consider masters, you know, from the past through, you know, even people who are alive today and still going. How did you choose the folks who ended up in the book?
The living or the dead?
Both? Well, both.
Well, the dead are easy because they're the most famous. And nobody argues about
it. Right, no one's going to say, oh, that Leonardo, he wasn't really a master.
Yeah, exactly. So it's pretty easy. There were a few controversial figures that I chose because it's just my unorthodox spirit. I like to kind of do things people don't expect. And then I have figures like John Coltrane, who I think is one of the greatest musicians ever, but certainly of the 20th century. But there's nobody would argue about that. So it was pretty simple. And I just wanted to make sure I covered every different field and aspect, because one point of the book is what makes mastery something about unique to the human brain. But no matter if you're in the sciences or in music or you're a lawyer or you're an athlete, it's the same thing. The brain functions the same way. Mastery is achieved through the same path that a great athlete takes as an Einstein. So I needed examples from all different aspects of life. The living were harder to choose. A, because they're more controversial. Why did I select this person over that? And B, a lot of them weren't willing to give me the time. I approached some people who just couldn't do it. So it was a harder thing to do. But what I liked about the living masters that I ended up with is they're not Da Vinci and Mozart. They don't seem like superhuman, like, my God, I'm never going to be like Einstein. They're a little more down to earth. They're still masters, but they're kind of human. You can relate to it. They're not so august. And so maybe it's an element of, I can relate to these people, like Yoki Matsuoka, for instance, who I think is a fabulous character. I'm not going to say she's Einstein, but she's an amazing character. And so I like the fact that I have people in there who've got like families and they have stories that it's not the same as Da Vinci, but you can definitely relate to it more.
Great. And you talked about achieving mastery a second ago. And in the book, you take, the idea that Malcolm Gladwell popularized of, 10,000 hours to gain a skill. But then you do this thing that I hadn't seen before of saying, well, after 20,000 hours, your mastery becomes, a whole different level and your way of thinking becomes more analogy-based rather than logical. I was hoping you could go into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's very exciting that you put it that way. Well, the 10,000-hour rule is a very exciting rule because basically it gives a figure, a statistic, a number to something that's very, very real. Like what happens to the human brain after so many hours of practicing something? A change occurs, a really exciting change that you can see happen in almost anybody who reaches that point. But then one of the things that they studied for the 10,000-hour rule was chess, because chess is the usual field where you can really demonstrate what happens. You can literally count the hours of practice. You can see at 5,000 hours, this is the level they're at 10,000 hours, they're a master. And what happens to a chess person when they go past the 10,000-hour rule and you go into like Bobby Fischer area, even greater leap occurs than in that 10,000-hour point. You've literally played so many games of chess, literally, I don't know how many thousands of games you've played, that you're not thinking anymore in terms of moves. You've got a picture. I call it there's a dynamic to the game itself that is something you can't put into words, that encompasses the whole game. It's almost a spiritual thing that has to do with you and your opponent. And you're feeling that dynamic, and you're thinking on a much higher level. That's what happens after all of these thousands of hours of practice in chess. But you can see it in music. You can see it in the sciences, where Einstein literally has his 20,000-hour moment with the second theory of relativity. You can see it in business, in Edison or whatever. And it's not just that you're thinking, it's not some wacky spiritual occult concept. This is really what I want to get away from. I'm not saying that it's like this woo-woo phenomenon that happens. You can explain it in terms of science. But when you bring about analogical thinking, it's not a logical process that's going on. When you've absorbed so much knowledge and information, it's thinking instantly. You're feeling what comes next before you can even say what it is. and it's powerful, and everybody who's ever done anything important will explain, will say, I've had that feeling. It's an intuition. Steve Jobs talks about it, and Einstein talks about it, and anybody else. And that's what I really, nobody else has written about it. Malcolm Gladwell, other people will talk about that 10,000 hour rule. But what happens when you go beyond it, the kind of creative levels that happen at that point?
Rap Genius. Yeah,
and in some sense, you get out in the book, it's not even entirely conscious at all. You talk about the fighter pilot who I think literally didn't even remember one of his most elaborate and dangerous missions.
Yeah, I mean, this was the last sort of decorated Air Force pilot in the United States Air Force. And he'd been training his whole life. And if you've ever, I've never been in a jet fighter, but it's, you're going at supersonic speeds. It's extremely stressful, and you're thinking in terms of milliseconds. And he'd been training his whole life on simulators in planes, but he'd never been in combat, because it's very rare to be in combat anymore. And he had put in well beyond the 10,000 hours of practice. And here he is in his first combat, and you don't have time to think. And he suddenly is doing these incredibly complicated maneuvers that are almost nothing he's even practiced before, that are just absolutely perfect, that he's able to escape from a dogfight in which it looks like he's going to be killed. And afterwards, he says he doesn't remember what had happened. He was operating purely on intuition. And, you know, what fascinates me almost more than anything is, this is, to me, the highest form of human intelligence that we can have. We tend to emphasize intellectual intelligence too much. But this kind of thing where you have a feel for it, which is what a carpenter will have with wood, what a musician will have with music, this is the highest intelligence a human being can have, and nobody ever talks about it. You know, it's like a mystery.
Yeah. And to that point, I think one of the key themes of mastery is, you know, not just attaining mastery, but mastery at what and why, right? Figuring out what field or, you know, specialty to study and to become a master in, and use this concept of life's work a lot.
Life's task.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And finding it, and maybe finding it by a circuitous route after, you know, or whatever it is. Mm. What do you consider your life's work, if you had to put it into words?
Me, for me?
Yeah, you personally.
Well, you know, I gave a TED talk about this about a year ago, or less than a year ago. And basically what I said was, throughout my 20s and into my mid-30s, I just was pretty much a bum. I mean, I wandered around. I had 60 different jobs. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to write, but I couldn't figure out what it was I wanted to write. Was it television, Hollywood, journalism, theater, film? And, you know, and I tried all different kinds of jobs. Like, I worked as in a detective agency, and I did, you know, hauling lumber for construction crews and stuff like that. And then finally, you know, at the point where my parents were about to give up on me, I had a chance to write. I met a man who publishes books, and it all kind of came together. And the idea for the 48 Laws of Power came to me. And then that was my life's work. That was my life's task. All of that weird experience dealing with a lot of awful people. I mean, in Hollywood, I dealt with a lot of awful people, which is normal. And the detective agency and everything else. I had so much experience with people, and I'd been writing for so long, that the 48 Laws of Power was like the natural culmination. But the thing was, I never intended it to be my life's task. I didn't know it. And that's what I try and tell people. You don't have to consciously know what it is exactly you have to create. You have to have a general sense that you are interested in music or math or science or whatever. You have to be connected to who you are, what excites you. But you don't have to have an exact idea of what it is that you're going to make or do or create. It'll come to you if you have faith and patience, and you study enough things and you're disciplined. What exactly it is you need to create will come to you.
Yeah, and that ties in also, you know, you talk about jobs and work a lot, but also this idea of a vocation.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you could break down the difference between a job and a vocation.
Well, the word vocation comes literally from the Latin meaning like a voice to call. And so it originally was a sense of you felt called to be work in for God for, in religious sense, and that was your vocation. But it later became more generalized, and it's a sense of a voice. This is at least how I describe it. There's a voice inside of you that says this is what you were meant to do. And if you listen to it, you're going to find your way to the right vocation. Now, I know that sounds kind of weird, but in the book, I make it a little more rational. When you're a kid, when you're 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, before you've listened to your parents, before school has drummed every bit of creativity out of you, before your friends have been telling you what's cool and not cool, you were drawn to certain things. You were drawn to sports or physical activity or to patterns and sounds and music or to something visual. That's a voice. Now, it's just a metaphor. I'm not saying literally you're hearing a voice, but it is something inside of you drawing you to these activities, and you lose it. After a while, you start hearing your parents, your friends, your teachers, and you're not hearing that voice anymore, and then you get lost, and you have no idea. And a concept like vocation sounds like just so alien to who you are. It's because you're not listening to who what makes you different, to what your real tastes and inclinations are. So I have many ways of how to get back to it. It's never too late. But it's better the earlier you are connected to it. When you're in your 20s, it's better. But it's never too late, and I have many practical ideas about how to reconnect to this vocation. But you're never going to get anywhere unless you do. It was funny because after Mastery came out, I never read my Amazon reviews. I never read any of my reviews because it's just I don't like doing that. But my girlfriend does. And she was reading the
Amazon. Reads every single one.
Well, not every single one, but a lot of them. She reads all the Amazon reviews and stuff. And there's this one guy who wrote saying, well, kind of refuting my book, saying, well, I've been painting for 30 years and I'm just no good. You know, I'm not a master. And so I put in 20,000 hours and here I am, I'm not a master. So therefore your book is bunk. And what it was after, I think she wrote back and everything, what it basically was is he's a lawyer who paints on the weekends and he's been doing that for 30 years. And yes, certainly he's done 20,000 hours probably in all that time. But that's not his vocation. He never dedicated himself. He was so afraid of being an artist that he had to go into law and make sure he had money. So it was never his vocation. He never went at it full with all of his heart. And so, okay, you're not going to be a master. So it's not just about accumulating hours. You could accumulate 10,000 hours working at an ad agency, but your heart isn't in it, and you're not paying attention, and you're not practicing it with love, and it doesn't mean anything to you. That's not going to lead to mastery. So it has to be something that's intimately connected to who you are, and there has to be a level of desire that goes into it.
Sure, and I think one of the things that people find difficult, and you alluded to this a little bit in the last answer, hey, I had some ideas for this, this idea of following your vocation, you know, finding a apprenticeship in a field you're interested in, combining, which is often unpaid, combining that with the need to, you know, make money, pay the bills, survive.
Uh-huh.
And I guess, you know, some ideas for, you know, managing to survive while pursuing a field that maybe you feel is your passion, but you're not quite there yet as far as, you know, being a master or being able to be established.
Well, everything depends on your circumstances. So if you're born with a trust fund, we don't have to worry about you. Well, we do have to worry about you because you're probably going to be taking a lot of drugs and not actually being serious and disciplined enough. But at least we don't have to worry about you. You know, you can go follow whatever it is that you want. But most of us aren't in that situation. It depends on the degree of urgency that you have to make a living. So if you have a family to support and bills to pay, I'm a very practical-oriented person and a realist. So it's never a matter of quitting your job and going into music because that's what you love. You know, you've got to... So you can still have your crap job at McDonald's or Pizza Hut or whatever it is that you hate because you've got to have a job. There's two ways of having that, though. It's sort of, okay, this is all I've got in life. Woe is me. I take this job, and afterwards I get drunk, and I do whatever I can to forget about it. Or it is, I have to accept this. This is a small little stepping stone in my life. It'll be over in 3 years. But in 3 years, I have a plan. I'm going back to school. I'm studying this in my off hours. I'm not spending my free time on the internet looking at porn. I'm learning a skill. I'm doing this, that, and the other. Suddenly, that Pizza Hut job is no longer a trap. It's no longer a prison. It's just a small little step. And furthermore, you tell yourself, everything that I do is a learning experience. So while I'm working at this crap job, which is what I did with all of my crap jobs, is I'm learning about people, and I'm learning about what I hate. This boss is awful. I'm never going to be that kind of boss. This is what people are like. You're observing everything around you. Okay, so that's the way you approach it. If you have a little more means and you're not on that poverty level, the mistake most people make, and a lot of young people do, and I don't blame them at all because I can understand it, is they, out of college, they rush for that higher paying job because they're so worried and freaked out. And the thing is, you can't be freaked out when you're in your 20s. In your 20s, you got to be adventurous. It's the only time in life when you can be adventurous. And you've got to try things out that don't necessarily have the biggest bang for, you know, the most amount of money. You got to try things. Maybe you take a mentorship that is free, that's unpaid for a few months, but where you learn a lot. Or you take a job in a small company where there's only four people and it may not last. It'll probably go under in 6 months. And you maybe those paychecks, they won't even be able to pay you. But you're going to learn so much because there's only six people there. And you're on. You've got to, that's your approach to life. You take the jobs where you're going to learn the most. That's the money that you're after, is learning skills. And then eventually it'll pay off. So it depends on your level of urgency and need. But that's sort of the scale that I would put it at.
I wanted to jump back to something you said in that answer about taking your time in, you know, bad jobs and basically any situation to learn about people around you and to observe people around you. You call that social intelligence.
Yes.
In the book. And I know that that's a huge focus for you, and I think going to be your next project.
It
right?
is
going to
be
solely
project.
Focusing
yes.
on
we're,
that.
We're selling right now.
What do we still have to learn about that? It seems like, you know, folks have been observing people for a while.
Oh,
you would think that everything there is to say about that
oh,
is,
my
has
God.
Been said.
Are you really asking me that? We have everything to learn. I have like a 500-page book to tell you about that. First of all, one of the things in that I'm selling the book is there's these studies that are showing that what I call the key to social intelligence is empathy, the ability that only human beings have, as far as we know, to put ourselves in the minds of someone else. So right now, I could literally transport myself into Nicole's mind while she's texting somebody, and I could imagine what's going on in her head. I mean, obviously, we've got a gender difference and a few other differences, but I can somewhat try, at least, to put myself in her head. And if I'm experienced at it, which I think I am, I can get fairly far with that. That's empathy. It's an incredible skill, incredible power that we're born with. They've shown that newborn babies, 1 hour, are showing empathy that no other animal, no other primate even can begin to display. In other words, the infant is responding to the mother's smile back and forth as if the infant can read what her thoughts are. Okay, but the study that I'm referring to, which is the University of Michigan that's been going on since 1979, has showed they have a test where they can test people's levels of empathy. And it's been going down and down and down and down. The last 10 years, it's plummeting among young people. It's given to college graduates. Basically saying kids in their 20s, early 30s, have the lowest levels of empathy that we've seen since 1979, assuming that it was already going down in 1979. What it means is people are so self-absorbed now, and it's not a moral criticism on my part. It's easy to become that way because of social media, because of so much technology, because we're not interacting as we used to with face-to-face with people. For various reasons, it's going down, 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 down. And so I'm saying a lot of people are losing social skills by the day. And we see it with all the snarkiness and cantankerousness, but I see it as a consultant where every day 20 people are coming to me with their problems. I said this, I hired a partner, I hired this person, they're a nightmare, I don't know how to handle people anymore. We're losing a sense of how to manage our social relations because we're losing that sense of being able to observe people, go inside them, think inside their minds. It's a sense of getting outside yourself and into the world. So it's not like, should there be another book on the subject? It's like, there is no other book out there on that subject, I'm afraid.
Rap G's.
And it's very basic. You're born with the tools for almost having a telepathic sense of what other people are thinking. Babies have it. Children have it to a very high degree. Indigenous cultures are probably our earliest ancestors, probably did have telepathic powers almost. You're born with the tool, you've just lost it. You're not connected to it, it's not being exercised. So in that chapter, I'm showing you how to exercise that muscle again by observing people, thinking inside of them, analyzing their responses to you. Instead of being all emotional about everything that happens to you in the work world, use it as something rational, a skill. Have a little bit of distance and not be so judgmental and emotional about your social relations. And, you know, the people that I show in the book who are masters at that, like Benjamin Franklin or people in the world today like a Bill Clinton, they have that approach. They're not someone that's so self-absorbed. They're always putting themselves in the skin of other people. Excellent. I'm sorry I got so long-winded.
No.
But you set me up. I said, you can't imagine why we need to learn
more
about that.
No, definitely. Mm-hmm. There was one line in the book. This is just jumping away for a second. Mm-hmm. It was, I don't know if you meant it as a throwaway line, but it was just sort of put in there and then not really addressed again. It was almost a parenthetical. Talking about how keeping fields of study so separated is, you know, has the effect of basically keeping people isolated and might in fact be almost like a conscious trick by people in power to keep, you know, disciplines and people isolated. And I was just hoping you could talk about that a little bit.
It wasn't a throwaway. You know, I think my editor made a comment when the book was still, when I was still writing it, we were discussing it, and he made a comment sort of thinking that that's maybe what I was implying. So I decided I'd make it very explicit with a parenthetical. Basically, you know, everything is so specialized now. And so even when it comes to thinking about society and to thinking about the way of life that we have or a movement like the Occupy Wall Street, which I was very sympathetic towards, everything is so separated and compartmentalized that nobody has like an overall vision anymore about what it is, why we live the way we live, why society is organized this way. Why does it have to be this way? Why, is there only communism and capitalism? Like these boxes of thinking that everybody has, you see it in the newspaper, nobody can kind of be a little more free-flowing about their ideas and begin to imagine a different way of organizing our world. And so things become so compartmentalized that it almost means that the only way of life we can have is the one that we have. So that was sort of what I was saying. I mean, it's, you know, I could write a whole book on that.
Right. And speaking of compartmentalization, you talk in the book about the split between art and science that you locate maybe about 500 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And but you say that that's starting to, those two sort of fields of study are starting to reconnect a little bit.
I think so. I think that's a very positive, exciting thing for the future. You know, there's some things in the sciences that were 20, 30 years ago that were pointing the way towards that. Things like complexity theory. I don't know if you're in up on that stuff, where chaos theory, where things are so complex that normal science actually doesn't really function anymore. Our kind of linear, logical way of thinking can't capture the reality. So science has to become more creative, more analogical. And they went, and this whole complexity group of people have approach to business and economics. They look at all of the sciences. And it's actually verging, it's coming almost full circle to poetry, to looking at the universe in almost a sort of a poetic fashion. And then people in the arts are getting very excited by things that are happening in the sciences and incorporating that in that work. Because, as I say, everything is actually unified. The brain doesn't come with compartments of science, technology, men, women, da-da-da-da-da. It's just one brain. It's all there. It's unified. It's one whole thing. And so that's the reality of the world we live in. The world isn't compartmentalized into these things. So the more you're able to get over those little irritating artificial divisions between fields, the closer you're getting to reality.
Rap G's.
And so what I love in the science stuff is people who are becoming kind of Renaissance figures who are getting closer to that reality and making incredible discoveries. You know, I have like Yoki Matsuoka, who's she's crossing the boundaries of robotics and electrical engineering and neuroscience, and now business. So she's able to create something that's more lifelike and real. But you could say that in so many other branches of sciences. Going back to more of like the Leonardo da Vinci type model. So that's what I'm talking about, and that's what I think is really exciting.
Excellent. And one of the other big ideas in the book that sounded a little familiar was the idea of the current, right? Which, for those who haven't read the book, is the idea of like having an idea, having a theory, you know, putting it into practice, seeing how it works in the world, and sort of adjusting the theory in relation to that, which sounds very similar to kind of the idea of praxis, which, you know, started and then sort of the Marxists took.
Wow.
And I was just curious if that was a conscious thing or if that, you know.
Actually not. You're the first person to ever say that. It probably is very kind of close to that.
Yeah.
That's true. Where I got the idea was I was reading a book on Michael Faraday, who's one of the great scientists of the 19th century, experimental scientist, who made some incredible discoveries. And he sort of described what I ended up using in the book as the current. And he was also dealing with electricity. And he was also somebody who was very poetic. So he knew kind of that it was like this alternating current. That was sort of the inspiration. But I think you're very accurate to point that out. The idea is very simple, that there's a current that the brain operates by, in which it gets like a drill drilling into something. It gets closer and closer to reality if you go through this cycle, this current. And it's trying something out, then thinking about it, then trying it again, then thinking about it, and da-da-da-da-da. But what happens in the world today is people break that. They're so divorced from reality. All they do is think. So you've got academics who are so lost in Derrida and whatever it is that they're never actually like boring into a wall with their minds. They're just thinking. Or you have people who are just so practical, who just accumulate knowledge about little tiny facts, and they never think about what it means. And so all they ever do is come up with meaningless statistics and studies that have no relation to reality. What you want is to combine the two. And one of the people that I loved interviewing was this V.S. Ramachandran, a neuroscientist. He is the biggest, loudest complainer about this. Scientists don't like to speculate anymore. They don't think that they can venture beyond just the facts that they've accumulated. They don't want to think about what it might mean because that's subjective, that's being artsy, that's being whatever. But speculation is the soul of science. That's what allowed Darwin to make his great discovery, or Einstein. Scientists always have to speculate and think big and imagine something, then go back and test and verify it. So I got very excited by that concept, because if you go back and forth between something like that, you're going to get somewhere. You're going to discover something very exciting if you go deep enough into that process. And it's how I do my writing as well.
Yeah. And speaking of unusual connections, I don't remember how explicit this was in the book, but you've been pretty explicit about it in some interviews. I know you're very into Zen meditation, and sort of the Zen concept of enlightenment and the enlightened mind seems to have a lot of overlap with your idea of mastery.
Well, yeah. I even included a Zen story in the book with the great Zen master Hakuin. They use the word master for someone who reaches that point. And what's so exciting about that is it's mastery of the most abstract thing, which is spirituality, or is of yourself, your ego, your consciousness. And yet, it follows the same pattern that I'm describing in the book. Hakuin, a great Zen master of the 18th century, put in his 20,000 hours of tortuous sitting meditation hour after hour after hour. And he makes the point, you can't, there's no shortcuts to it. So no one's going to reach enlightenment after 2 weeks of doing Zen meditation. It's going to take you 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And to make it actually something really true enlightenment, it's probably going to take you 30 years. So I found that very exciting. I mean, I've been practicing meditation only for about 4 years now, pretty rigorously. And I can see incredible progress as compared to where I was in the beginning. So if you can do this through meditation, if that also follows the mastery pattern, then what doesn't, you know? Yeah. The most ephemeral spiritual thing that we could never put into words, really, enlightenment, it also follows that pattern.
And because, of course, we're, you know, from Rap Genius, it's a harken back a little bit to 48 Laws of Power, which mm-hmm. is definitely iconic amongst rappers, and as I've found out lately when I started carrying your book around, rap industry people, who all comment whenever they see me with it. How did you feel when you sort of first started finding out that that book was adopted by rappers, by a lot of rappers, by a lot of hip-hop community people? I don't know whether you first heard it in interviews or songs where people would say, hey, Robert, I saw this thing.
No, I can remember exactly when I first said it. It was, I think, 2001, maybe 2002. Jay-Z, in an interview for Playboy magazine, quoted, I think it was Law 18, 19, about don't isolate yourself in a fortress. Mm-hmm. And he quoted that law. And that was like the first, wow. And then it started kind of, you know, drip, drip, drip. More things started coming in. And then rappers started actually contacting me. And then, you know, 50 Cent himself contacted me. So at first I didn't see, like, it was that, I saw the Jay-Z interview, but I didn't know that it was infiltrating that world so much. And then when it started to become clear to me, I was very, very excited. I'd always had a kind of mixed emotion about the book being successful with people in Wall Street, because I don't have a business background, and there seems something a little bit ugly, to be honest, but connecting my book with some of those people on Wall Street. You know, I felt like I needed to take a shower, or that I really shouldn't have been promoting that. But to hear that black people in hip-hop or music who've been the worst exploited people in history, in the arts, you know, going back to Duke Ellington and all of the great jazz artists, my God, you know, how horribly they've been exploited. To find that they were using the book to turn that dynamic around, to become entrepreneurs, to become owners of the music, to understand that it isn't just about being creative. You have to be hard and tough and understand these laws that are going on. I felt very excited. Personally, I've always had a deep connection to black culture. For me, it's through jazz, because that's my first love in music, is jazz, and basketball, because I'm just a basketball junkie. But there are other elements of culture, the writer, some of my favorite writers and poets. So I was very, very excited about that. I can't say that I'm like a hip-hop aficionado. I have my loves. I kind of grew up, because I was in New York in the early 80s with Run DMC, and I can even go back to Grandmaster Flash. I'm that old. So I have my taste, but I wasn't like a hip-hop aficionado. But the fact that it was the underdog using the book to turn around this exploitative relationship, and that it was connecting to black culture, that's probably the most excited connection of my book that I've had.
Wow, that's amazing. And 48 Laws of Power, I know one of the big critiques of that, and the Art of Seduction, and the other books, people will call it amoral, which I was surprised to see you quickly turn around and claimed as a title in some interviews. Said, you know, I don't approach things from, I think you said, a moral standpoint or something. I would quote.
I don't approach the book from a moral standpoint. Yeah. I approach my interactions with people on a business level, or my girlfriend, with an ethical approach. Mm-hmm. Basically, what I meant is, this is power. This is how it's operated for 5,000 years. This is what pharaohs were using, and this is what Bill Gates is using. When he closes the door to his office, Bill Gates is not actually following the tenets of the Dalai Lama. He's following the 48 laws of power. And he's not sitting there thinking, is this, when I'm crushing Netscape completely and obliterating it from this planet with a very calculated strategy, he's not thinking, is this the right thing to do, where I'm going to be putting all these people out unemployed, et cetera. He's thinking of, this is the logic of business. This is what I have to do. So business, the world, power, politics is amoral. It is completely an amoral experience. There are people who consider moral things, and they may be good at the power game, and there are others who don't consider it, who are also good at the power game. But I wanted to write a book that isn't about what you should be doing as an ethical human being, because I treat you as an adult. It's not up to a writer to tell people what to do as far as what's ethical. Your parents, your whole background. I am showing you that this is how the power game operates. And no other book is doing that, because everybody's afraid. They're all afraid of actually saying what it is that is going on in this world. I see it, you know, every day. I pick up the New York Times. I look at it. I see examples day in and day out in every single business. The music business, you can see a million examples every day of the 48 laws of power. How come nobody is writing about that or tackling it? It's because we want to imagine that this very human endeavor of power is this sort of noble environment, and it's not. So maybe I went a little far in the other sense of describing it in a completely blank, amoral way, but I wanted to correct this kind of namby-pamby, childlike, innocent little viewpoint of the world, which just kind of nauseates me.
So. Okay. And, you know, 48 Laws of Power certainly had a lot of disparate fans over the years. Who's the most surprising person that you found was a fan of the book, famous or not?
Fidel Castro.
Really?
Yeah. Paris Hilton. That was the art of seduction. You know, I was in Italy when 48 Laws of Power came out for a book tour, and a high-level official, I was having lunch with somebody very high up in the government, the Italian government, and he was telling me about all these people in the Vatican who were reading the book.
So I don't know whether to be amused or frightened by that. That's something. And speaking of surprises, obviously you work closely with 50 Cent. You co-authored a book with him. What's the thing about 50 that our audience would be most surprised to know?
That he's really he's like really quiet and self-reflective, and he's not really gregarious. So like one time, we were in Vegas. He was, I can't remember if it was the VMA Awards or what was going on. And he's really good friends, or he was really good friends with Floyd Mayweather Jr. And we were driving out in like three Cadillac Escalades to Floyd Mayweather Jr.'s mother's house in an hour outside of Vegas in the middle of the desert. And it was her birthday, his mother's birthday. And, you know, and it was pretty wild being in this car, and everyone's smoking pot, and I'm getting kind of a contact high. And we get there, and it's this pretty wild party. I'm like the only white guy there, but that doesn't matter. I felt totally comfortable, and I was really having a great time. But what surprised me was 50 was sitting in the corner, like, watching television. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He was watching sports or something. He was mixed. He was talking to Floyd for a while, but he's actually a lot in his head. He's a very thoughtful person. He's not a party person. He's actually a little bit uncomfortable. I think what it really is that he explained to me, he's got a great fear of not being in control of things. It goes back to his earliest years and when he's growing up without a mother or parents of any kind. He never liked getting drunk because he felt like he wasn't in control of things. He wants to feel like he can determine what happens. So in a party, in a situation like that, it's a little bit not his element. He's fine, he can do it, and he can be very charming and all that. But he's happiest working out, doing a business deal, coming up with a song or something, and not like partying or anything. He's very disciplined.
Interesting. And just, you know, winding down, one of the fascinating things, like little tidbits when I was reading about you, and meditation specifically, you're very into, it seems, confronting your own mortality.
Yes.
So that you literally envision your last day on Earth every time you meditate.
Yeah, I mean, there may be a couple times where I fail to do that, but I try to do it. Get to the point where I, you know, I see it like happening in an afternoon and a particular kind of day in a certain setting. And I find it extremely, extremely therapeutic on various levels. It's not morbid. It's not a morbid thing at all. What's actually morbid is to run away from your own mortality and not think about it. And where it's therapeutic is, for instance, if I'm going through a meditation and I'm trying to empty my mind and suddenly pops up this thought of this asshole who's like doing some trick of making my life miserable, and I'm going, fuck, why is that in my mind? I'm trying to empty it. I go, ah, remember that afternoon in 2031 when you're on your deathbed and you're dying? You don't give a fuck about this guy. It doesn't matter. What does it matter? Why are you worried about this petty little thing when, in fact, your days are numbered and you've only got 20 more years to live or 30 more years? Stop it. So I use it in that sense as almost an exercise. It also makes you connected to being alive. You know, the fact that you know that this is what's going to happen to you, you can see it and feel it, makes you feel kind of alive and even a little sort of happy in a way. There's many therapeutic values. The 10th chapter of the 50th law is devoted to how you can turn the thought of mortality into something sublime. So 50 and I, he thinks about death a lot because he literally died and came back to life. And in my next book, it'll be the 24th final chapter as well. So it is something I find, not in a morbid sense, but in a complete therapeutic sense.
Okay. And as a big jazz guy, obviously you talked about Train earlier. Favorite Train record?
You know, favorite Train record. I mean, when my first exposure really to jazz was Love Supreme. But I've heard it so many times that I can't almost listen to it anymore. I know my favorite Miles Davis album.
What's that?
That's Bitches Brew. Mm. My favorite Coltrane, I don't know. There's so many great, you know, I love the Village Vanguard recordings, but you're asking me like for a specific album.
Or even just a performance of, you know, one song or one solo that, you know, jumps to mind as a favorite, if not the favorite.
Well, he's got like four versions of Africa on the Village Vanguard recordings. I sort of really love that. I know there is something. There's like a track on Kulu Ke Mama. Is that how you say it? Is that the name? That I actually really, really love and play all the time. And then I love Afro Blue is one of my favorite tracks, which is on which one? That's not my favorite things. No, it's Live at Birdland. So I've got things and thing on. I love Giant Step, a whole bunch of tracks on that. But there's a quality to Coltrane that nobody else has, and it is a spiritual quality.
Right, searching kind of.
A searching sense of urgency that just connects, it gets under your skin, and it's like with life itself. There's just something, it just makes your skin crawl. It's so beautiful. And our track like Alabama, you know, his ballads, his beautiful ballads. I don't know. I could go on and on.
Yeah. I got to meet for a while another writer I know was actually drum tech for Elvin Jones. Not, you know, past the great quartet years, but, you know, towards the end of his life. And just hearing stories about what a powerhouse, you know, that guy was.
Elvin Jones.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. He was with Coltrane.
Yeah, he was with him for Miles. The great quartet years. Yeah.
For
Love Supreme and all that era.
I wanted to interview for one of my masters, was a great jazz person. I went through a whole list to try them, and I really wanted to get McCoy Tyner because he's still alive, he's still very conscious, and would have been a great interview, and couldn't get it.
that's too bad. We'd love to hear what he had to say.
Yeah.
And finally, I know you're a huge basketball fan.
Yes.
So what did you think of LeBron's choice in footwear wearing Kobe sneakers?
That was really cool. You know, actually, I have to go get some support tennis shoes to sneakers to live in for the next month and a half. I think that's what I'm going to go get.
Excellent. Robert Green's choice of footwear inspired by LeBron James. You heard it
here
first.
Well, I'm a Kobe Bryant fanatic. I'm a Laker fan. I'm going to be buried in purple and gold because I love the Lakers. I go back really way far. I'm not a bandwagoner. I go back to the 60s, I'm afraid. So Kobe's, you know, like my god. But I'm kind of warming up to LeBron, and certainly what he did there is kind of helping me in that process. There's a slight 0.5% chance he would come to the Lakers. I don't think so. But I thought it was really cool. He's not as bad as I thought. Two years ago, he was like, oh, what a scumbag, you know, with the whole decision thing.
Sure.
But maybe he's not so bad, you know, and then he said some things that I thought, well, maybe the guy's kind of wise in a way. When people were really bitching at him, I think it was after the finals 2 years ago when they lost. I forget to whom, Dallas maybe. And he said, well, you know, these are a lot of people out there who just have nothing else to worry about but my life. You know, go get a life if you have to think about that. And I thought, wow, I like that, LeBron.
Interesting. And are you a football fan at all?
I love football.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask, we're talking, I believe, the day after or 2 days after the Richard Sherman thing.
Yeah.
And I was curious how the author of literally the book about power thought about
from a courtier point of view, what he said about Crabtree, that's obviously a little extreme. And his coach reined him in saying, you know, let the team have the spotlight. But the reaction really pisses me off. I do find it kind of racist. You know, football is a vile game. And the way the Seahawks play defense, the way Richard Sherman plays it. And we love it. We're all involved in it. It's like, you know, mirror neurons, all the men out there. We're just like, wow, this is so exciting. And then he comes off and he's supposed to suddenly morph into some, you know, Louis XIV courtier who says the right thing. No, the guy's got his adrenaline pumped up. He just, with his fingertips, knocked away the touchdown that was going to give the 49ers the game. Of course, the guy's pumped up. He's going to say something. I do think it's racist. Because he's a great player and he's a smart guy. He went to Stanford. How many of these people complaining about him could say that they graduated from Stanford? So it pisses me off a little bit. And I think it's a double standard, you know. Yeah. And, you know.
Excellent. And what's next? I know you have the book on social intelligence.
Well,
is there a title?
Yeah, it's
title
called
The
Laws of Human Nature. And basically, I'm saying, going back thousands of years, we humans, there are certain laws that we operate by, things that like envy, insecurity, narcissism, stuff like that. And I'm going to break it down for you. I'm going to show you these laws. I'm going to show you how they operate in people so that you can now go out and see people in a different light and you can read them. I say it's like decoding a mystery. You'll be able to figure out what people are thinking, why they act the way they do, through this key of understanding these kind of set in stone laws about mm-hmm. human nature.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. It was really great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was our talk with Robert Green. If you liked what you heard on Outside the Lines, make sure to find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. While you're there, make sure to leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests like Robert Green. You can also follow us on Twitter at @OTL_podcast and check out our brand new website, OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com. Join us in 2 weeks when we sit down with Michael 5000 Watts, co-founder of the seminal Houston label Swisha House Records. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotero.
You don't give a fuck about this guy. It doesn't matter.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
How many of these people complaining about him could say that they graduated from Stanford?
Our invaluable intern is Julia Hannafin.
My God, you know, how horribly they've been exploited.
This episode was recorded by Tommy Fisher.
No one's going to reach enlightenment after 2 weeks of doing Zen meditation.
And special thanks go to Nicole Otero for setting the whole thing up.
This is what pharaohs were using, and this is what Bill Gates is using.
Our music is by Psionic.
You know, I see it like happening in an afternoon and a particular kind of day in a certain setting.
Join us in 2 weeks for Michael 5000 Watts of Swisha House Records. We'll see you then outside the lines.
Did we go over the allotted time?
There's no allotted time at all, yeah.